This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We welcome everybody tuning in throughout North America on Sirius Channel 220, XM Channel 206, and of course, everyone listening worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, along with my producer, Lee Delapina. And every week on this show, we have the opportunity to visit with so many of the people that make sacrifices every single day of the year to bring you the product that you see on the racetrack each and every day. And you know I'm talking about the trainers of our sport. I tell you every single week that there are no days off. If you're a horse trainer, you are there every single day, holidays included. And all of the trainers we talk to have that deep appreciation for the sport, including the two that I will visit with here this evening. Eduardo Caramori will join me in the first half of the program, and Bill Connolly will be with me in the second half here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Eduardo Caramori, a native of Brazil, has trained 349 winners to date. His runners have earned more than $7 million in purses here in the United States, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Eduardo, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. Happy to have you with me. And, you know, I was thinking about it as I was getting ready for our interview here. And, you know, it's a long way from Brazil to Churchill Downs or Keeneland, but you've been able to make it work out pretty well.
Well, yeah, just when you're saying about working every day of the week, I remember when there was a little boy, I would pick up my grandma. Was a Christmas night, and then was a janitor on the apartment. And I said, man, this guy is working on a holiday. I was confused. And then here I am, 50 years later, working on holidays and Christmas and every day. But anyway, that's our life.
Well, it's true. There are no days off if you're training racehorses, and it's a 365-day-a-year commitment. But I've had so many trainers come on this show, Eduardo, and they tell me that they do it for the love of the horse, and I assume it's similar for you.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of in our case, it's a family affair. It's a lifestyle. I mean, we do everything together. Well, my two boys, not boys anymore, and my wife, and then, you know, they're involved with one is apprentice, the other is a vet. I mean, they're all involved in about the horses and about racing. You know, it's kind of when they start here in America, I couldn't do much because the boys, they're little with soccer, this and that, and then I have to stay around there. But today, I cannot do anything without them. I mean, they are the reason we're still going. I mean, myself, you know, because we got this big outfit. It's small, but it's everything us, you know.
When you were a boy growing up in Brazil, Eduardo, did you have other family members that were involved in the sport that you were able to learn from?
Not really. I was born in Sao Paulo, one of the biggest cities in the world, but I guess I'm a family that we used to have little farms around Sao Paulo, not big projects, but when I saw the animals and I saw horse, you know, I don't remember when, but I thought, well, that's you know, something connected, and I'm trying to do all my life directing to that. I went to the vet school, thinking about not horses but animals. I used to go to some cattle farms, and that's how I direct all my studies when I was in the vet school, going to the cattle business and the horses. You know, in the cattle farms, you always have horses, you ride horses, and You know, I never had that thinking about work with a horse, because I had a neighbor that has a little horse farm, and he was a member of the jockey club, was the racetrack in São Paulo. It's kind of elite stuff. You know, you don't feel like you belong. And even going to the vet school, you know, the horse people were kind of a little funny for me at that time. And I passed by, you know, I did all my studies, horses, of course, but I never thought I'm going to be there. And basically, I finished vet school. I entered a big project in Amazon and a Volkswagen farm they have there in the middle of the Amazon. I spent a year there. When I came back, that's when I met some vets from Europe, Swiss and Germany vets, and you know, when you see the technology, when you come back to Brazil, we just see the technology on the horses, the cattle or the other, not much. And then that's why I start on the horses, you know, after that. That was 1982.
Okay, and that was, you never really thought about getting into working on the vet side with the horses. It was always mm-hmm. on the training side?
Well, because I was a rower myself, and I did that for a long time, since I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, rower is also a really hard on the people time. You have to go put the boat in the water early in training, countless hours, come back sometimes in the afternoon. And the races, they're really, really hard. And and I did well myself. And I had the discipline to keep going. And I was, when I said, going to the jockey club, we see the trainers and see the horses, I kind of, myself, looking for some kind of challenge on that area. Because at the same time as a boulder, when you're doing a vet school, I enroll myself in a physical education school also in the same university of São Paulo. But I was much serious because I couldn't do both same time. And the classes on the physical education are soccer, volleyball, you know, dancing, you know, and some physiology, that things that I already had on the vet school.
Sure.
And just the anatomy was different. But, you know, I was doing some classes randomly. I never thought I'm going to finish, and I'll concentrate on the vet school and the cattle. But suddenly I was on the other side. I was doing horses, and I was thinking about the physiology on the exercise, trying to compare what I did as a rower with the trainers do with the horses, and it's a different world. And I tried to come in, and then it's kind of hard breaking in, not knowing much about the people, the connections, you know.
Any comparisons, Eduardo, between being a rower and then what people were doing with the horses?
I mean, when you go to the high level or training to the high level on the sports, you know, people wrongly said, well, it's healthy in the sports. Well, sport means healthy. No, you have to be healthy to practice sports. Exercise is one thing, means healthy or health. But sports, especially high level, humans, horses, they you know, you have to be healthy enough to compete. And you know, just because it's hard on you and humans or horses. Of course, the humans, they tell you, or you tell the guy, the horses, they try to tell sometimes as a trainer. You know they're telling you. You listen or you not. It just depends on the situation. But it's the same thing. We normally we have to train hard because the competition is hard. There's no way you can train easy and compete hard on any in different can be horses or humans.
Talking with trainer Eduardo Caramori on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Eduardo, what was that moment, or what led to that moment when you finally decided, hey, I want to train horses for a living?
Well, wasn't my, you know, like people's destiny or something like that. I was not looking for that. I thought it was when I started doing some research, when I went back to the physical education, a guy from the was doing his PhD on lactic acid. It was on the swimming team, and I was helping him drawing the blood stuff. And then we said, well, we can do that with horses, you know. And then we got a guy that the guy who says a neighbor knew another guy. We got some horses and start doing. We're talking about 1980, beginning of the 80s, okay. You know. And doing kind of a try to do lactic acid on horses. And if you go to see the research at that time, people were doing also in Germany, in Norway, wherever, Sweden. But not much, you know, it's kind of hard. We're digging in nothing. We didn't have much of a research to go with. And then did things die quickly because it was expensive. But it was my door to the racetrack, to the Jockey Club of São Paulo. And then I met a guy that was interested, and I have some owners that was interested, and one thing go to the other, and they said, well, maybe you can do this, you can do that. And I start breaking kneeling, something like I never did, but the guy was helping me and trying to do something different. And suddenly I got there, and then the guy, you know, one of the biggest breeders in Brazil, they have two guys, like Calumet and Claiborne kind of guys in Brazil.
Yep.
Peixoto de Castro family and Paula Machado families. And one of these guys, the Peixoto de Castro, said, I wanted this guy here to bring here to be some kind of a member of the team. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And suddenly they fired the trainer. I got there, and I was the trainer. I have no experience at all.
You're kidding.
Some, but you know, it's kind of a crazy. All the guys, all the friends are there because they're a private training center. All their friends said, "You guys crazy," and then some of the guys took the horse away from me or from them because they don't want to, you know, give their horses. And, I mean, they're right. I mean, they're right that time. You know, I'd probably do the same thing today if somebody said, "Well, give this 26-year-old kid." You know, all the Claiborne horses, you know.
Wow, so you really did just kind of fall into it then. And
I start to the top. I came to the top to the bottom. You know, I saw, but I was afraid to get the job. But my job first wasn't to get there because I'm going to be the assistant, start with the babies and do some kind of a research, some lab. They build a lab, this kind of stuff. That's why I was thinking about the physiology of the matter, not of the train itself. And then when the guy said, well, you're going to be the trainer, and I said I was scared. And then one guy gave me a good advice. I said, you scared what? You scared the good horse? You have to be with the good horse. You know, go try to get a good horse. They offer the good horse, just stay with him. Be afraid, be scared, get away from the bad horse. That's a good advice that I carried to today. The only thing I had the good horses there, I don't have the good horses here. I mean, just not in the same number.
Yeah, not yet.
Yeah. Well, the guys are there. I mean, the good horses, they said they're going to teach you. Well, maybe they're not going to teach you, but they know what to do. You learn from them because they're winning, and then they keep going and go to the next level. The bad horse, you just stay same place. Don't take you anywhere.
You know, before you came to the United States in the early 90s, I guess around 1992, Eduardo, you trained more than 60 stakes winners in Brazil. What's different?
Well, exactly. That's the point. My winning percentages were really high. I impressed everybody. But I was in a top. I got a private training center, the two best jockeys in the country, the best breeder operation, you know, everything, my favorite, you know. Plus, at that time, they have a stallion by Lee Farr named Gadir that was just star with me. I mean, they star, first crop was with me.
Wow.
I mean, you see today the statistics, he won like 11. It's like I was starting with a today with the tappet. I was the private trainer for whatever, Gainesway, and get all the tappets.
Wow.
So I'm going to be doing better than I'm doing today, I'm sure.
What a way to break into the business. You were somewhat
spoiled
from the start.
That's why, but I was smart enough to know I was just a piece of there. I knew I was in the right place. I was like saying, well, I'm the man. You know, I'm going to live here. I'm going to go to, you know. But, you know, that took 5 years, 60 stakes is like, you know, it's like a stake a month.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't have that many stakes there. It's not like, you know, like here, you can go find a stake. No, the stakes are there, and then and everybody knows. It's no, but, you know, it was a good run, and then they liked me there. I was liking there. But after 5 years, you did everything twice. And it's not like no more challenge, because it's a challenge every day. It's just a matter of, I was afraid not keeping doing the same, you know, because it's, you know, you just try to win again. You know, you don't see, you know, that happen very often, because you have to have the same good horses again. And then, you know, and I was thinking in going a little further, like come here, because we sent some horses at that point. We sent to Roma Canelli, and it was like in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they did well here. And McAnally went there, and I met him, and then he picked another two, the best horse I had. I said, man, they're going to take another two of my best horses. And, you know, and then I said, why are you not going? And I tried to convince them, you know, my boss over there, to just send me the horse or just send me there. I said, oh, we need you here. I said, oh, I know, but, you know, you can do somebody here, you know. But and then finally I saw it's not going to happen, and I decided, I said, well, I'm leaving by the end of the year. I'm going. And they said, well, I cannot hold you here. If you want to go, you go. But our relationship kind of ends there. They never give me a support or anything to make me come or go.
Was it
I met Dr. Harthew.
Yep.
He was losing in Rio one day, and then the guy said, oh, that's Harthew. And then he went to the place I live. It's a beautiful tree. He was impressed with the organization, everything he had. And I said, I want to go. And he said, oh, just come to Kentucky. I said, well, but, you know, I'm in a training business. I don't want to go to Kentucky. I said, you don't know racing in Kentucky? I said, I know Churchill Downs, Kentucky Derby. What about the rest of the year? I said, Keelan, it's 2 weeks. Oh, what about Turfway? Never heard about Turfway or Ellis Park or wherever. I said, you come to Kentucky, you go to my office in front of Churchill Downs. I introduce some guys, and I talk to the boys, to my boss. I said, I got an offer. I got an offer, a good job in Kentucky. I'm going there at the end of the year. I said, okay, fine. And I came here, knocked on his door, and then he introduced me to some guys on the backside. And I would stay with the Jink Fires for probably a month, just walking there and then just, you know, helping the guys, you know, knowing how to do a stall or put the shank on the horse, because everything is different equipment-wise.
Really?
You know, yeah. And then I said, well, and then I got a couple of friends that in Brazil, they had a horse here or there, and they said, oh, yeah, no, we can do it. Not the guys that my main boss, but the guys like their friends or people that they knew. Because by the time I got there, everybody left. The old friends, they opened the training center to new guys, and the new guys came to me because the organization was good. The guy was me, but they said, well, we'll try. And these guys, they're the guys that support me here till today. Like the Anderson Inc., these kind of guys are the guys that they're with me since then. Not the main guys, but they like the idea to have a horses in the U.S. And, you know, you get a horse here and there from them, you know, once in a while.
You know, it's interesting, Eduardo, because you think back to the success you were having training for the top outfits in Brazil, and you mentioned probably on average winning like a stake a month, and then you come here and you're kind of starting from the ground up. Was that difficult for you after having so much success in your homeland?
Well, that's what it come with. You know, I wasn't thinking about being a successful or being a guy that was successful or gonna be a successful guy here. I was just changing. So, well, we did my part there. I'm gonna try here. I think you had a after 60 stakes in 5 years. We got like a money in our pocket is less than $50,000. That's why I got net.
Wow.
That I could bring here. Two kids, $50,000. I could buy a nice car in Brazil or come here. And I came here and I said, well, with $50,000, maybe we squeeze a year and a half, 2 years maybe here, eating hot dogs. And, you know, and just go. The kids come here, adapt really quick. And I said, and it's not fair for the kids. I mean, the kids are here. They're nice. We're just going to be parents here. We're going to try to go to some racing. I didn't exactly, you know, train. I know it was, I was a trainer, but maybe as a vet or whatever, you know, truck driver or something. Just keep going for this, my experience. My English is bad today. Can you imagine 23 years ago how bad it was? I mean, it was terrible. And I knew it. You know, my wife was a little better. She went to the UK. I said, at least one of the two has to answer the phone, because when the phone rings, it's terrible. Nobody, oh, it's not for me. No, it's not for me. Nobody wants to answer the phone because, you know, you can't understand and they can't understand you. But anyway, it was kind of a, the way it went the first 6 months. The kids are fine. And then I went back to Brazil and I said, guys, I'm in Brazil, I'm in Kentucky, I got this, I got this. I wanna be a trainer. I know Alice Park. I make a little folder, came back and I talked to the guys that I knew in the past. Some people say yes, yeah, some people say, oh, maybe, and then, you know, it's something to start. I got some horses and these Anderson guys, we got came here in September by five yearlings, and you know, it's hard. You want to kill somebody, just give a new guy five yearlings. You know, you can't go anywhere training five yearlings for next year. But anyway, it's a goal from here. But I have a horse, I don't know if you remember, it's a Sasa Lemos. Was
yeah.
A horse that was a bad horse, but I got lucky with him. He was a, we won a John Battaglia. And I enter a horse. The horse didn't do anything. Then I enter him. He won a maiden race, 7,500, and win the 100,000 Derby prep. I said, man, that's easy. Much easier than there. But I was kind of, you know, but I knew I was just lucky. And I think that's it. When you think about what I had in the past, you ask me what I had here. I'm not saying a handball, whatever is the word, but if I knew that my part wasn't the main part is the horse, was there, is this today, it's much easier, you knowing that if you have a condition to work on a horse, you can do better than if you don't have, make you feel better. I'm not ashamed to walk in horse or doing stalls or, you know, whatever, because I was here for the boys, the wife, and then living in America, kind of living the dream without knowing what the dream was, but something different. I was learning the language and, you know, it was fair enough. I had that horse, Fafa Lemos, he was man. But after that, you know, happened. It was like a 15-minute success, and then we got offers to sell. No, we're going to run to the Derby. You know, next time he was hurt and he never run again, like he run like 2 years later. But, you know.
Eduardo, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, because we're getting short on time, only about 4 minutes left, believe it or not.
Uh-oh.
We could spend another hour talking about your career because we're just getting started with it. But let me ask you this question in just a couple of minutes. What's been, obviously you come here, you take a huge risk leaving your homeland of Brazil to come here to the United States to take that job. You uproot your family. You basically are self-made as a trainer, having to learn everything from the ground up. What's been the most rewarding part for you about training racehorses and getting to the point that you are right now?
Well, I mean, I think it's just being with the family. Because I didn't tell one time, we run a horse from Rio de Janeiro on an undercard race in the Arco de Triunfo. This was 19, 89. We run a horse and a race before the arc and a mile. And I was there, and then I saw a couple of coming with a little trailer from whatever, Denmark or Belgium. They came with a horse the day before on Saturday, and they won a race. Two guys came with a little trailer, won a race, and come back home. I said, well, that's a thing it would be nice to do one day. And then I was here in America, and sometimes I go with the family, even if you win a race, you know, just a race. No, we're all together. I think that's a reward. Of course, winning. We run first American in Kentucky Derby, winning the Flamingo, or winning the New York Suburban, or even winning a Derby Day last year with Berlino di Tiger. That's nice. You know, that's not that's, but that's just for the record. Because that's just accomplish or achievement as a number of you can go to my stats. Of course, in America, the stats means everything: how many rings, how many championships or Breeders' Cups. But for me myself, being with the family in the winner's circle is great.
Eduardo Caramori here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Eduardo, your story is absolutely incredible, and you'll have to promise to come back on again for the second half of this story, because I know we just kind of scratched the surface here, but really appreciate you taking the time. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you'll receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so I'll get those to you. And my friend, thanks so much, and continued success.
Yeah, exactly, because as I had told you before, training a racehorse, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's anyone can do it. But make a living of training racehorse. That's a job.
Yeah, well, you've done it, and you've done it very well, Eduardo. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Great to hear your story, Eduardo Caramori here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Man, think about that. Falls into it in Brazil, training at the very top level for the, as he said, the Calumets or the Claibornes of Brazil. No experience, had never trained a horse before. He gets that job. Then he decides, hey, what the heck? I'm going to pack up my family and our entire life in Brazil, and I'm going to leave and come to a foreign land here in America, and I'm going to make a go of it. Talk about taking a risk. Got to love Eduardo Caramori. Second half coming up next, Bill Connolly going to join me. Stay with us. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. The Fasig Tipton November sale is the market leader. The 2013 November sale had the highest average of any mixed sale in the world, with 24 horses selling for $1 million and higher, more than any other breeding stock sale in the world. And the 2013 November sale provided an outstanding weanly market with a $500,000 foal and a $100,000 plus average, while also producing the highest priced horse sold in North America last year, when Better, Better, Better went under the gavel at $5.2 million. The Fasig Tipton November sale, Monday, November 3rd in Lexington, Kentucky, the market leader. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet.
Woo! Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at hrtv.com.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
HRRN is your home for the 2014 Breeders' Cup Championships. We'll bring you over 17 hours of coverage during Breeders' Cup Week, leading up to our exclusive broadcasts of the Breeders' Cup World Championships, October 31st and November 1st, live from Santa Anita. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule of times, affiliates, SiriusXM info, or to listen live online. The Breeders' Cup World Championships, only on HRRN.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is David Cohen.
This is Gary Siaka.
This is David Jacobson.
This is Gary Gallo.
This is Bruce Brown, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Welcome back to the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna alongside my producer Lee Delapina in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. An amazing visit with Eduardo Caramori in the first half of the program. Such an inspirational story. And the second half promises to be much of the same. Bill Connolly, the 57-year-old native of Austin, Texas, is going to join me. He has trained 1,171 winners to date. Those runners have earned more than $15 million in purses, and he is nice enough to spend some time here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. And you know, when you think back on your career and the way things got started, it's very similar to so many of the trainers I've had the privilege to speak with on this program, in the fact that you were kind of born into it, so to speak, with your dad being a trainer and getting to learn from him. Take me back to the early days of Bill Connolly.
Well, actually, I remember my dad bought a broodmare. That's how we kind of got in the game. And I was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old, and it just kind of took off from there. But, you know, I've been doing it basically my whole life.
Yeah, what do you remember about that first horse and being around that whole environment and everything?
Well, I mean, at the time, didn't really know much about horses other than we had some cattle and really didn't have a thoroughbred. We had a couple riding horses, and he decided he was going to buy a broodmare in foal, and this was in January or something, I think, and she foaled maybe sometime in April, and here we had a baby and, you know, watched it grow and fooled around with it and kind of took off from there.
Was your dad the only member of your family that was involved with racing, or were there others?
No, he was the only one.
Would he encourage you to get involved in the sport?
No, I wouldn't say that, but, you know, I enjoyed it from the very beginning, and I was hooked early on.
Did you ever have any thoughts of doing anything else, or was it always, hey, I want to be a horse trainer?
The only thing I probably would have wanted to coach football.
Really?
It's probably my only other real love. But I didn't go to college, and so that kind of went out the window.
Did you play football growing up?
Yeah, I just played, you know, through high school.
Did you
but
ever
always,
have the chance
always
to?
Loved it. Still love it.
Did you get the chance to coach it on any level?
I did. I coached some eighth graders a few years ago, and really enjoyed it.
All right. So, what's more difficult then, coaching eighth graders in football or training a young 2-year old?
they're similar. Although I will say one thing: those eighth graders, whether they believe you or not, they all say yes, sir. Thank you, sir. I'll do my best, sir. They're at that age where they're not, you know, they don't have the attitude yet. So that part was good. Whether they listen to you or not is a whole different story. But they didn't act like they did anyway.
Well, I can imagine there are some parallels, though, aren't there, in terms of the feelings that you get and the reward that you feel when you do the right thing with a horse and everything comes to fruition and he wins a race or even just gets to the races, which is so hard to do. And then when you teach those young kids and all of a sudden you see the light bulb go on and things come together, are there some parallels there, Bill?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you see him develop, really for the first time you see him on the track, the first time you see him on the field. You know, at the end of the year or something, he's like, what strides they've made, you know, and the way they've moved, the way they've figured it out, things like that. Absolutely.
Well, we know about your career highlights with training horses. What was your career highlight with training the young kids? Did you ever have an undefeated season or anything?
Well, I just coached the one season.
Yeah.
Actually, we had a good team. It was, like I said, they were junior high kids, and it was a friend of mine, a trainer also, Wayne Mogi. His son played, and he was kind of in the jackpot on needing a coach. And he knew I liked football. He said, man, we need some help. Why don't you help me? And that's kind of how it came about. But, we had a good team that year. I mean, they won all but the last game, which kept them out of the playoffs. But, you know, we had fun.
So was the Dallas Cowboys for you?
yeah, as a kid growing up, yes, sir. Yeah, I've kind of evolved to being a Bengal fan now, though, over the years.
Wow. Now I'm a Steeler fan, so I don't know what's worse. Yeah, I'm a Steeler fan, so I don't know what's worse there, Bill.
heck.
So, all right, so then you grow up, you don't go to college, you say, okay, I want to get into horse racing. So you knew all along, I want to be around this game, this is what I want to do. What was your first experience in working, say, on the racetrack?
I worked for Clarence Peacoot, actually. I worked for him a couple summers, then I went to work for him out of high school. I was working for my dad, and he'd gone to the farm for the winter, and I went to work for Clarence, and was with him off and on. And then I worked on the starting gate for a while, and I ponied horses, I galloped horses, I did all that. I probably worked on the starting gate 3 or 4 years, I guess, and. I was trying to think what else. I never was a jock's agent or anything like that, but I've done most everything here.
You know, that's interesting. I don't think I've had a trainer on this program yet that has told me that he worked with the starting gate crew and on the starting gate. That is such a unique job and such a job that is overlooked in this sport so often. Tell me a little bit more about that, Bill.
I tell you what, I really enjoyed it and I learned an awful lot. And, you know, the people that I worked for were good too. They really were. They knew what they were doing. And, you know, back then, I mean, this is a long time ago, we only worked 5 or 6 people. I mean, you think of it now, they have, you know, 14, 15, 16 guys working, to run 8 or 10 horses. We had 12 horse fields every race, and there was literally 5 or 6 of us.
How do you do that?
You work your ass off. You really do. You know, and you got to trust the guy next to you pretty much. And, you know, you're splitting horses in the gate, things like that. I mean, you learn the horses too. You know their habits.
I'm told that that's one of the more dangerous jobs that you can do on the racetrack. Is that true?
If you're not careful, absolutely. You know, one thing about it with the horse, as long as you control their head, you're going to control the game. And that's the whole key in the gate. You got to control their head. If their head gets away from you, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. Talking with Bill Connolly here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So as you're working with your dad and learning from him, what are some of the things that he taught you, Bill, that you're still kind of including in your operation and your philosophy today?
Well, probably the main thing is you know, don't overtrain them. You know, and I think that happens a lot of times with people with good horses. They're you know, they get on certain, you know, they think they've got to just go that much harder. And, you know, the horse has got to tell you, and you can't overwork them. You can't overwork them.
And that's the same type of philosophy that you've used even today?
I try to, yes, sir.
How do you know when you've overworked a horse? Will they tell you? I mean, by their body language?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, you know, their body language, their feed tub habits, things like that.
Bill Connolly on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. So, Bill, you decide then to go out on your own after working with your dad and some being around some other people. I guess that was, what, 1980? Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What led to that decision, and how did you know you were ready?
Actually, a former trainer named Chuck Grigsby, he was a good friend of mine, and I was galloping horses for him at Beulah Park one spring, and he told me, he says, you know what, he says, I'm going to take another job. I've got, he had, I don't know, six or eight horses, maybe with probably four or five different owners. And he said, I'd like to let you, I'd like to turn these horses over to you if you want them. And that's kind of, that talk went through the fall maybe. And then he was going to take the winter off. Back then you wintered horses. And he called me, said maybe it was end of November, first of December, something like that. And he said, you know, I'd like to get these guys together and let you take these horses over. And as it worked out, I had, I don't know, probably, I guess it was three or four owners out of that group, and it took off from there.
When you mentioned working on the starting gate, galloping horses, you've done so many other things, but you ultimately settle on being a trainer. How did you know that was the right facet of the industry for you?
I don't know. I just always enjoyed it. I always enjoyed doing that. And, you know, when I was working with my dad, he gave me a lot of leeway, too. I mean, it wasn't like he was, you know, just on top of me drilling things in my head. We did things pretty much kind of together, you know, experiment, failures and success. So from that end, you know, you pick it up from there.
How much has the game changed, Bill, since you first got involved with training?
Oh, it's changed dramatically. That's changed dramatically. You know, one thing is just the sheer expense, you know, of what it takes to keep them, you know, at the top. You know, and naturally the purses have kept up in some places, but some places they haven't. And that's by far the biggest complaint I have.
Does that make you have to adjust your operation and the way you do business?
To a degree, but you try not to adjust too much. I mean, you want to keep it on the same level and the same, you try to figure out, and generally you cut yourself is what you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you cut your family or you cut, you know, your wife, things like that. That's generally the way it goes.
Yeah.
Which isn't good. I'm not proud of that, but, it's a fact of life.
Yeah. What do you remember? I mean, this is a game that has the highest highs and the lowest lows, and we hear that all the time. What do you remember about the first winner that you ever saddled in that particular day?
I don't know. It was fun. I remember that. It was great. You know.
Can I ask you how you celebrated? Do you remember that? Do you remember anything about the celebration?
No, I really couldn't tell you. It's been too long ago.
Come on, you're not that old. It wasn't that long ago.
Well, actually, you said 57. I'm 58. So,
see, now I had your birthday as being just a couple days away.
No.
I guess
actually,
I just
my
missed.
My birthday is in July.
See, I shaded you to 57. How about that?
All right.
I was looking out for you, man.
I appreciate it. You're the only one.
So what do you enjoy most about training racehorses?
You know what? I don't do it all the time, but when I occasionally I actually groom the horses myself, and I really enjoy that. I really do.
Really?
You know, if I do. You know, that's something I like to do. I don't mind running one. You know, a lot of times it doesn't work out that way, and you know, you have help. You got to delegate things out, but you know, sometimes we're a little short or something. I jump in there, and I enjoy that. It's fun.
You know, outside of your dad, tell me about some of the other people that helped you get to where you are today.
Well, I mean, Chuck Grigsby, you know, he helped me quite a bit. Like I said, he got me started with clients. You know, I had no business. I was, like I said, I was galloping horses, and I had one horse of my own at the time and was working for him, and he's the one that, you know, jump-started that, which was great. Like I said, Clarence Pugh, being around him was good. You know, my dad being around him. I went to Gulfstream one year after out of high school and worked for Charlie Sanborn.
Okay.
I don't know, out of a whim, I graduated from high school and said, I'm going to Florida, you know, just to see it. And I went to Gulfstream Park and I got a job with Charlie Sanborn and you know, groomed horses for him that winter for, I don't know, you know, 4 months, something like that. And that was great. It was good. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, at that age, that had to be a tremendous
right.
opportunity and experience.
I was 17 years old, you know. And, it was fun. And one thing I do remember, my dad was at, it was Latonia then. He was at Latonia that winter. I'd call home, you know, once a week or something, and he'd tell me, oh, yeah, it's 25 below here. And I'd be, oh, yeah, well, it's 72 here. We had a cloud in the sky.
Oh, come on. You weren't that kind of sun, were you?
Yeah. Oh, you got to rub it in when you can.
No, what a great.
You're going to get it back. You might as well get it when you can.
Yeah. Well, oh, absolutely. Well, what a great opportunity for you, though. 17 years old. You're working at an operation down in Florida. What a great learning experience. I'm sure that's helped you even now with what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, things that were working for Mr. Sanborn, they, you know, I still do them. Yes, sir.
Now yeah. You mentioned Latonia, which is now known as Turfway. You spent an awful lot of time at Turfway, so obviously the cold weather didn't bother you because you had a lot of success with the winter-spring meets up there and the holiday meets, I can remember. So the cold weather didn't bother you a whole heck of a lot, and you had a lot of success at Turfway.
Yeah, it was home. You know, I'm married and raised two kids there, and you know, tried to keep some stability in their life, and that was it. That was it. That meant being at Turfway in the winter.
Are the kids involved with racing at all?
No, they're not. No.
No interest?
They like to go, and they come out periodically, but they're not. They're racing fans. My son likes to bet, They're not avid horse people.
Does he ever ask you for a tip?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, how's the horse going to do tonight? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. You know, and get texts a lot, you know, congratulations and things like that.
That's got to be kind of cool, though, to have your kids involved at least on that level.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So did they ever think about getting involved in the sport, or did you just kind of discourage them from going down that road?
I never put it on them at all. And you know, they had other interests, and that was good, you know, growing up. So, but, I mean, like I said, they like the horses, don't get me wrong, but they're not horse people, I guess, would be a good way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. Bill Connolly joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Bill, let's talk about one of your true career milestones. I mentioned training 1,171 winners to date. Well, you hit number 1,000, I believe it was in 2009 at Ellis Park, and that had to be a very special day for you.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yes, it was. I remember it was a turf race that came off the grass and the mud. The filly went wire to wire, and it was fun. Yes, sir.
You know, I've had a lot of trainers on the program tell me that when they get close to a milestone like that, they start to feel, they really admit to feeling a little bit more pressure, and all of a sudden they're not winning races like they were before, and it takes a while to get that milestone win. Was that case with you?
That happened with me, yes, sir.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. You're only as good as your horses. And, you know, that's the bottom line. You're only as good as the stock you got. And, you know, probably at that time we might have been, you know, a little transition or no telling what. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. How long did it take you from to get from 999 to 1,000?
I think it took, you know, a month or something like that.
Wow. Did it really?
Yeah.
Wow. That had to be a relief. It, you know, it's jubilation, but it had to be a bit of a relief when you finally did it.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Who are some of the other horses that you've had a chance to be around over the years that you're just never going to forget?
Well, Sadie's Dream, she's one I won't forget. And I had a horse when I was a kid. Well, it was named Dependabrook. He was a good horse. Gosh, I'm trying to think. I had a filly, Freedom Ride. It was a nice filly.
Yeah.
I had a good filly, Flyaway Angel.
What makes those fillies so special for you?
Probably the fact that they're grinders.
Yeah.
And you know, they can handle it, I guess is a good way of putting it. You know, to get a horse to run good consistently year in and year out, that's a good feeling. You know, to keep a form over an extended period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that maybe even a little bit more rewarding when you have a horse that can compete at a high level year in and year out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got a filly now, Sweet Cassiopeia. She's just as solid as she can be, and she's six now. And, you know, it's just fun to go in and see her every day. I mean, you know what you're going to get.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a testament to your program that you're able to keep horses around for so long and run them into their 5- and 6-year-old seasons. That has to speak volumes as to what you do with your program.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, we do work hard at them. I've got a good crew, and they're good people. And they're horse people that enjoy their horses. They really do.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of those people have been around for a while. Tell me about some of the people that have, you know, kind of worked with you for a long time and helped you achieve this success.
Oh, I've got help that's been with me, you know, 20 some odd years, 25 years and things. And, you know, they're all good people. Brent and Kim and Tony and Roy, Rollo. I mean, they're good, solid people. They come to work every day and they do their job and they enjoy their job. And, you know, if there's a problem, they jump right in there. And that's what I like.
When did you first start to get the sense that Sweet Cassiopeia might be something special?
Well, actually, you know, she had run in Canada,
okay.
And I got her as a 4-year-old, and she had made several starts. And first time we ran her, she was second in the stake. That was at Presque Isle. But no, she was a nice filly, you know, from the beginning when I got her. Like I said, I didn't really develop her, so. But she's been solid as a rock since then.
That's nice when they just fall into your lap like that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah.
And then I thought this was interesting. You had the chance to train a couple of horses that were bred and raced by Patch and Wilkes Farm. And people
yes.
listening may or may not know that name, but Patch and Wilkes is known for having registered white thoroughbreds. And you had Patch and Prince and the White Fox, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes,
both
sir.
Of those were registered white. That had to be kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one thing about it, they stand out. They stand out. People know them.
Is it the same?
Good or bad.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You'll know where they are at every point in the race.
Absolutely. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
It's a track announcer's dream, isn't it?
Right.
Hey, did you ever think about doing that, being a track announcer?
No. I don't think I've qualified for that.
Oh, that's great. So when you're training a horse like that, let's take the white horses. Any mm-hmm. difference? They're all thoroughbreds. Any difference in the way that they react and behave as opposed to your standard dark bay or brown?
No, not really. I mean, they were good horses to work around. And in fact, I've got two of them right now. And I've got a 2-year-old that hasn't started yet, and I've got a 3-year-old which had made one start last year. And, I mean, they're fine. You know, they go about their business good. You know, you have to be careful with medications on their legs occasionally because they are white-legged. And, you know, they'll have somewhat of a reaction as opposed to, you know, a darker bay or something like that. But, you know, other than that, they're fine.
What are some of the goals that Bill Connolly still wants to achieve in this career?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. you know, just I enjoy the horses. That's my biggest goal. That's my biggest goal. And I enjoy the people. You know, the owners are good. The right owner and the right is fun, and that's what it gives me pleasure. You know, the people that are with you and on your team and like what you do, I guess.
Outside of your dad, when you were growing up, were there other trainers that you kind of looked up to or thought, hey, you know, maybe someday I could be like that trainer?
I'm sure there's a bunch, but, you know, thinking off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you.
Who's the best trainer you've been around?
The best trainer I've been around. Gosh, I'd have to think about that. Maybe we can talk about something else while I think about that. that's a loaded question.
Well,
there.
No, it's funny because I'll ask that question from time to time, and most trainers, I think yourself included, I'm getting that sense, are very humble people, and they don't necessarily like to brag about themselves and all of their accomplishments. But when I say, you know, who's the best trainer, I guess the best trainer you've ever seen might be a better way to ask it. And inevitably, you know, even Hall of Fame trainers will say, oh, well, you know, Charlie Whittingham was the greatest trainer I ever saw, and to watch him do what he did was remarkable. I guess that's maybe where I was going with that question. If there was a trainer or trainers that you've seen over the years that you said, wow, now that guy can – he can train.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that stands out to me, and this is, and not that I was around him. I knew one of his former assistants very well, but Sug McGahee, the one year, I can't remember when it was, at Belmont when he won six of those grade ones, I think that one day, that, you know, to do something like that is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, things like that. When Mandela won the race, Breeders' Cup Day. What do you win? Was it three or four? I can't remember now.
Yeah, it was remarkable.
Yeah, you know those kind of situations. I mean, they're off the charts.
What's the most races you've ever won in a day?
Three, I believe.
That's a good day.
Yeah, it was a good day. In fact, it was a good two or three days. We won like, I don't know, six or seven in a row. That was fun.
Wow.
That was a good time.
Yeah, just in the zone for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, believe it or not, this has really flown by. Just a couple of minutes left, but I always like to kind of wrap up by asking trainers outside of horse racing, what other interests do they have? I know you enjoy football, obviously. What other interests do you have when you're able to get away from the racetrack for a little bit?
I mean, I like sports. I like all sports, you know, basketball, baseball. I grew up playing it. That was one thing about my parents. They let me do things like that, which was good. And I always enjoyed that and still enjoy it. Still enjoy going to games. I play a little golf, not very often. For one thing, I'm not very good, but don't have the time for it. But I do enjoy it when I can. I guess that's about it, really.
You know, Ian Wilkes is quite the golfer. Maybe we can set up a match there.
I don't know if you want to bet on me.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there. I'll echo all those right. Sentiments for sure. Well, Bill, look, it's been so much fun to hear your story and to visit here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Like all of our guests, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so I will get those to you, and I'll look forward to seeing you around the racetrack.
Hey, I appreciate it very much.
All right, thanks, Bill. Continued success.
Thank you.
Bill Connolly here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Eduardo Caramori in the first half of the program. If you missed any portion of this show, go to horseracingradio.net or Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. A podcast will be available for you as it is each and every week. Don't forget tomorrow night, the Bristnet.com call-in show comes up 6 to 7 Eastern time. And on Friday night, our Express Bet weekend stakes preview as we get you ready for all of the action coming up each and every weekend. My thanks to Eduardo Caramori and to Bill Connolly, my producer, Lee Delapina, doing a great job here in studio. I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.